you know, California establishing things like a wage board that can set a wage for a whole industry. It's a really interesting kind of step towards thinking bigger about ways to empower workers on an industry-wide level. This is something that a lot of people think is really the path for reaching workers on the scale that we need to reestablish union power in America, given how bad our labor laws are and how hard it is to organize at scale. And so it's encouraging, and it's also, I think, an illustration of what you're seeing all over the country, which is red states are running in a real negative direction on labor rights, and blue states, in response, are trying to become more and more progressive on labor rights. And I think that's a trend that's going to continue for a while.
We just have 15 seconds, Hamilton, but I wanted to ask you about Sean Fain, the head of UAW, being the guest of the Bidens at a White House dinner, and the UAW's stance calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. Do you think Sean Fain is getting through to President Biden?
I don't know if he's getting through to President Biden. I haven't seen a lot of evidence based on what Biden has done that Sean Fain has got through to him on that point. Biden's done a lot of nice things for the UAW. But as you said, the UAW and many, many other unions representing at this point the majority of union members in America have called for a ceasefire in Gaza. And that is one issue that Biden is really not being responsive to the labor movement on. So I hope that changes.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Hamilton Nolan, labor journalist. His new book out is called The Hammer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for this program comes from KBOO members in the Portland Housing Bureau, announcing the opening of the North Northeast Preference Policy Home Ownership Waitlist, helping longtime and displaced residents to purchase a home in their community. The application deadline is April 19th. Information for the Preference Policy Home Ownership Waitlist at portland.gov/PHB.
Support for this program comes from KBOO members and Earth and Spirit Council, presenting the world premiere of their documentary film, The Power of Ceremony, Earth Teachings for Future Generations, on Sunday, April 21st at 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. Tickets and information at earthandspirit.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Commissioner Renee Gonzalez unveils plans to consolidate power around homelessness regulation in the mayor's office.
An audit of the Joint Office of Homeless Services finds Multnomah County still lags behind in providing shelter space and housing placements.
And we hear from the local artist behind the 100 Kites exhibit honoring the 100 journalists killed in the Gaza Strip.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 17th, 2024. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Althea Billings. City Commissioner and mayoral candidate Renee Gonzalez wants the mayor to have control of homeless camping regulations. His proposal would immediately ban homeless camping citywide in Portland. Those who violate the rules would face fines up to $100 or up to a month in jail. Under an ordinance drafted by Gonzalez's office, the mayor and their designee would be able to update policy at any time so that, quote, camping in or upon any public property or public right-of-way is restricted to the fullest extent allowed by federal and state law, end quote. This rule would put public camping decisions solely in the mayor's office, removing any input from city commissioners. Gonzalez's proposal comes as Mayor Ted Wheeler attempts to pass his newest camping ban through City Council. Wheeler's camping ban last year also sought to ban camping citywide. It failed after a lawsuit challenged its constitutionality. Wheeler's new ban limits its reach to camping on public property. It also introduces a $100 fine for violators, but limits jail sentences to just a week. Gonzalez's harsher proposal looks to take advantage of a potential shift in constitutional rules on camping bans. Next Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear a case from Grants Pass on whether it's constitutional for cities to ban camping on all public property if the city doesn't have enough shelter beds for homeless individuals. Grants Pass v. Johnson could make criminalizing homelessness constitutional. Gonzalez's proposal has a clause in the event that the courts decide in Grants Pass favor. In that event, his ban directs the city to increase fines up to $500 and jail sentences to 6 months. Wheeler and City Commissioner Carmen Rubio have strongly criticized Gonzalez's proposal, but Gonzalez may have the 3 votes he needs to pass his ban as an amendment to Wheeler's. Commissioner Dan Ryan has signaled support, and Mingus Maps remains undecided.
Shelters overseen by the Joint Office of Homeless Services have wait lists that can stretch up to a year, are regularly at capacity, and are ineffective at moving people in shelters into permanent housing. This is the conclusion of the city's first audit of the 8-year-old agency. The audit reads, quote, "There is a risk of trauma if people are unable to access shelter when they need it, and a risk that they will give up on trying to access the homeless response system altogether," end quote. The joint office is run by Multnomah County and co-funded by the City of Portland. It operates dozens of shelters across the region, as well as programs that help move people into permanent housing. The audit found that family shelters have an expected wait of up to 6 months, while those on wait lists for shelters for individual adults waited up to a year. Multnomah County has an estimated 2,000 shelter beds and estimates that more than 5,000 people are living unsheltered in the county on any given night.
Portland's minimum wage will bump up 50 cents this summer, reaching $15.95 starting July 1st. Across the state, minimum wages will also increase. In urban counties outside the Portland area, it'll reach $14.70, and in rural counties, the minimum wage will be $13.70. The minimum wage in Oregon has been on a tiered system since 2017 to account for different costs of living in different areas. Since 2023, the annual increase in the minimum wage has been tied to the rate of inflation. That's around 3% for the hike for the different wage tiers. According to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Living Wage Calculator, a single adult in Oregon with no children needs to make $24.30 an hour to meet all their basic needs. That's nearly $10 more than the new highest minimum wage in Oregon in Portland. For comparison, the federal minimum wage has been stuck at $7.25 an hour since 2009.
In Portland tonight and tomorrow, an art installation of 100 kites will be on display in Southeast Portland to honor the 100 journalists killed in the Gaza Strip. KBOO's Janka Soderberg spoke with the artist who designed the exhibit.
Over 100 journalists have been killed over the past 6 months in Gaza. That's in addition to 5 Lebanese journalists killed by Israeli forces and 2 Israeli journalists killed on October 7th by Hamas or other Palestinian resistance groups in Israel. The International Federation of Journalists has estimated that nearly 1 in 10 journalists in Gaza have been killed over the past 6 months of the Israeli invasion, despite protections for media workers under international law. The Committee to Protect Journalists and other press freedom advocates have called for increased protections for journalists, citing the crucial role the media plays in providing both short-term information and long-term documentation of war. Targeted 100-plus Kites is an installation project inspired by academic and poet Rafat El-Arir's poem, If I Must Die, which pays tribute to the many journalists and media workers who have put their lives on the line to report on the horrors unfolding in Gaza and to prevent the suppression of news in the Gaza Strip. Mona Honeidi is the artist who designed the installation here in Portland.
The 100 kites represent every fallen journalist that we know of so far. The kites were inspired by Rifat Al-Arir's poem, If I Must Die. He was a very beloved professor and a very amazing academic, amazing poet. He had been threatened like multiple times for days. He got threats online and on his phone. He was actually at the time sheltering in one of the hospitals, and he felt that he believed the death threats. So he felt that he needs to not be there. He needs to leave. Otherwise, everybody that's sheltering there would die with him. So he left and went to his family home. And he was killed there along with his sister, his brother, and their children. The poem he wrote in 2011, but he shared it widely with journalists and online. I guess he knew that these threats were not empty threats. So it's a sort of a targeting of people who have academic knowledge or people who have just knowledge. He's not a journalist. Was he a militant? Of course not. He's an academic and a poet. And I think that if you target the knowledge centers, if you target the people who teach, if you target the people who are learning, then you are definitely creating a certain holes within the community. You are weakening the fabric of a community. And I think that this is all on display right now. So I named the event 100 and plus kites because in anticipation of these numbers growing, and unfortunately we are somewhere around that number right now. They're diamond shaped kites, but mostly in various sizes to represent different people. There is one kite wall that we will project some archival footage on and some aerial footage of Gaza on. And we have some lights, we have some sound design. So it's just like we've created the space. It's almost like I think of it like as a memorial. I've had a lot of help from a lot of amazing artists. Lois Levine is doing outreach for us and a lot of amazing research work. I have architect Emily Dawson helped to put the kites up and like turn it from a miniature that we have made into something that goes into the full space. I have a plethora of local artists that have made kites for me. One of them is Sarah Farahat, Nabil Muhammad. You know, John Berenson did the sound design. Kristen Hall is doing we did the montage together on the film, and many, many, many names to help me make kites. It would take a few minutes to rattle them all off, but you have to come to the installation today, and you'll be able to see all our beautiful names on the wall. You can bring family, obviously not super young children, but it's definitely, I would say, young adult and up.
That was Portland artist Mona Honady. Her installation, Targeted, 100 Plus Kites, is on display for two nights only, tonight, Wednesday, April 17th, and tomorrow, Thursday, April 18th, at Performance Works Northwest, located at 4625 Southeast 67th Avenue in Portland. That's near 67th and Powell in Southeast Portland. More information can be found on their website, pwnw-pdx.org. That's pwnw-pdx.org. The art will be on display tonight and tomorrow from 6 to 9 p.m. at Performance Works Northwest in Southeast Portland. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Jenka Soderberg.
Seven jury members were seated in Trump's hush money case. House Speaker Johnson could lose his job over Ukraine aid, and the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case that could undo charges for January 6th rioters. With more on the story, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I should be right now in Pennsylvania, in Florida, in many other states, North Carolina, Georgia, campaigning. This is all coming from the Biden White House.
Former President Donald Trump was back in court Tuesday as the first seven jury members were seated in his hush money trial. The former president drew a rebuke from the judge for muttering at one prospective juror during the painstaking selection process. Trump continues to allege that Judge Juan Merchan is totally conflicted and should leave the case. Attorney General Merrick Garland defended President Joe Biden's mental fitness when asked by a Republican congressman about special counsel Robert Hur's report on Biden's handling of classified documents.
I have complete confidence in the president. And I reject your characterization.
Some Democrats have criticized Garland for not pushing back against Hur's statement that Biden could present himself as a well-meaning but forgetful old man if charged in the case. Hard-right Kentucky Congressman Thomas Macy says he would vote for Georgia colleague Marjorie Taylor Greene's resolution to oust Speaker Mike Johnson. Johnson says he'll bring up three separate bills to aid Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, and a fourth on Republican foreign policy demands. Macy says that's not good enough.
Because the motion is going to get called, okay? Does anybody doubt that? The motion will get called, and then he's going to lose more votes than Kevin McCarthy.
Johnson might look across the aisle to survive until the end of this Congress in January. California Representative Pete Aguilar says Democrats can't control the theatrics of Green and the Republican caucus, but dislike the chaos. And he says Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries should be the next speaker.
We want Hakeem Jeffries to be speaker. Whether that happens in this calendar year or in January, that's the focus. Mathematically, it's possible.
House Republicans have sent two articles of impeachment against Homeland Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas to the Senate, highlighting what they call the Biden administration's mishandling of immigration. Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee says Senate Democrats should not just toss the charges.
They can't just ignore the fact that we have the power to try all impeachments.
The Supreme Court's conservative majority appeared skeptical of how a federal obstruction law was used against January 6 insurrectionists, including former President Trump. A former policeman indicted in the riot challenged the law that forbids destruction of government documents and interfering with official proceedings. Justice Neil Gorsuch asked what situations could be charged.
Would a heckler in today's audience qualify or at the State of the Union address? Would pulling a fire alarm before a vote qualify for 20 years in federal prison?
Finally, four Republican state parties are asking the high court to take up a fringe Arizona lawsuit seeking to ban voting machines. A federal court threw out the suit by election deniers claiming the machines can be manipulated. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Street Roots digital producer Kanani Cortez about the latest edition of the paper, The Vendor Issue. Then we'll speak with Linda Neal, the author and co-founder of the Earth and Spirit Council, about the upcoming world premiere of the documentary, The Power of Ceremony, Earth Teachings for Future Generations. At 6, it's Beyond Your Front Door. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio. And then at 7, Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 36. Tomorrow's weather, sunny with a high of 68. Today in history, in 1986, the alleged 335-year war between the Netherlands and the Isle of Scilly, that's S-C-I-L-L-Y, ends with a peace treaty, bringing an end to any hypothetical war that may have been legally considered to exist. For over 300 years, no peace treaty existed, but no shot was ever fired either. That would make it one of the world's longest wars, a bloodless one, and a thoroughly silly one. The quote of the day is from American playwright Thornton Wilder, born this day in 1897. Wilder said, quote, "Whenever you come near the human race, there's layers and layers of nonsense."
Tribes and conservationists are banding together to go to Congress for a monumental push. They want to protect more public lands before the November presidential election. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A coalition of tribes and Western conservationists are working to protect more public lands before the November presidential election. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
On Tuesday, the coalition was joined by members of Congress in front of the U.S. Capitol. They called on the Biden administration to expand and designate more national monuments, which are permanently protected lands. That includes creating the Basawabi Swamp Cedars National Monument in Nevada, the Dolores Canyons National Monument in Colorado, and several in California, such as the Quitsan National Monument. Here's Councilman Donald Medart of the Fort Yuma Quitsan Indian Tribe.
This is our history book. To be able to go out into the desert to show my children and to show other tribal members and community members, this is who the Quitsan people are. This is where we came from. These are lands that we traversed. These are what our songs talk about. And it gives it that much more meaning to our people.
In all, the coalition is pushing for 11 new or expanded protected lands. The group presented a petition of more than 800,000 signatures in support of their efforts. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
The lieutenant governor of Minnesota, who's Native American, is traveling to several states to try to help President Joe Biden's reelection bid. Chuck Kornbach of station WUWM in Milwaukee reports on the efforts of Peggy Flanagan.
Flanagan is a member of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe and has served as Minnesota's lieutenant governor since 2019. This year, with Minnesota considered safe political territory for Joe Biden, Flanagan, a member of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, has been traveling to swing states to campaign for Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. Last weekend, Flanagan spoke in Wisconsin. She says, for one thing, she believes in the Biden-Harris ticket.
But two is because, as a Native woman, it is my responsibility to make sure that I am caring for my community, but also ensuring that we are strong into the future. I'm a mom of an 11-year-old girl, and I want her to know that voting is a tradition in our family. It's how we show up for each other. It's how we actively care for each other.
Flanagan says President Biden has brought billions of dollars in federal money to Indian country and has a record of standing up for tribal families.
The compassion with which he has approached a lot of these issues around boarding schools and the federal boarding school system, shining a light on that has been incredibly powerful. You know, he fought to uphold the Indian Child Welfare Act before the Supreme Court and won, which I think many of us were holding our breath and were so relieved that that was protected.
And Flanagan says Biden chose Native American Deb Haaland as Interior Secretary. But as NPR has reported, Republicans hope Donald Trump can win votes among tribes with promises of improving schools, job creation, and safe communities. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Judge Sarah Hill, a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, was ceremonially sworn in to the federal bench in Tulsa, Oklahoma last week. The Cherokee Phoenix reports, among a crowd of nearly 200 people, Hill was welcomed as a new judge for the Northern District of Oklahoma. Hill's the former Attorney General of the Cherokee Nation and made history with her confirmation in December. She's the first female Native American federal judge in Oklahoma. Tribes and national Native organizations say Hill brings a critical perspective and deep knowledge of federal Indian law. There are 39 federally recognized tribes in the state. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Black Maternal Health Week is wrapping up, but health disparities for pregnant Black women continue to be an issue. From April 11th to 17th this year, the high death rate of Black mothers is in the spotlight. Black women are three times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than their white counterparts. Family physician Dr. Patricia Egwatu at Kaiser Permanente in Seattle says racism is at the root of these disparities, which create barriers to healthcare access. She says lack of access can lead to problems during pregnancy that are preventable or treatable.
But they may exist prior to pregnancy, and then it gets worse during pregnancy if it's not managed a part of that maternity care. So there are more pregnant women that have chronic conditions such as hypertension, diabetes, and heart disease that are amplified during pregnancy.
The White House has released a proclamation recognizing Black Maternal Health Week. The Biden administration began recognizing the week in 2021. Egwatu says there are some warning signs that any pregnant woman should be aware of and check in with their physician if they develop.
You might get some changes in your vision that is not your normal, like fuzziness, you can't see as well, or an excruciating headache. You could also develop new swelling in your lower extremities that's making it difficult to get around, or even new shortness of breath.
Egwatu says physicians also need to recognize the role of racism in medicine. She says continuous medical education is important for learning how to confront these biases. With that, Iguatu says it's important for doctors to understand how they can provide people with resources.
Asking the questions about personal barriers. So does a patient have issues with getting to work, childcare, transportation? What's their education? What's their cultural background and language? And do they even have a cell phone so we can connect with them?
That was Dr. Patricia Iguatu, a family practice physician in Seattle.
New research links common pollutants like smog and vehicle emissions to the risk of dementia. Dr. Alan Cronenberger Andrade is a member of the American Academy of Neurology, working on his master's degree at a university in Brazil. Andrade says the study of more than 2,500 adults shows a need for more local research on air pollution's impacts on cognitive health.
We see that there is really evidence linking air pollution to cognitive decline and dementia risk.
He points out that stroke and cardiovascular diseases such as ischemic heart disease and atrial fibrillation are other key links between air pollution and dementia, and vascular issues also contribute to this connection. Dr. Fabrizio Ferreira de Oliveira, also at the Federal University of Sao Paulo in Brazil, says one component of this study looked at people's proximity to high pollution sources.
So if they live near a highway or near a very polluted area, they can have more cognitive impairment than those people who live farther from those regions.
He suggests conducting ongoing studies to determine if reducing air pollution could lower the risk of dementia and cognitive decline and better overall health outcomes.
Oregon lost 33 gray wolves last year in human-caused events, the highest number the state has recorded since it started keeping track in 2011. As a result, the growth of the gray wolf population in Oregon has plateaued for the first time since wolves began coming back into the state from Idaho in the late 90s and early 2000s. The state counted 178 wolves last year, the majority of which are in the Northeast. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and the federal government are investigating 12 deaths as potential poaching cases, including 7 where poisoning was involved. Eastern Oregon ranchers legally killed 16 wolves last year after they were found to have killed livestock. That's the highest number since repopulation started, and much higher than the average of 4 in the 4 years prior. Some wolf advocates are concerned that the increase in sanctioned kills makes poaching seem more acceptable to the public. Amarok Weiss is a senior wolf advocate at the nonprofit Center for Biological Diversity. He says that research shows that allowing for the legal killing of wolves leads to increases in illegal killing. He added, quote, "Last year's population decline is a shameful result," end quote. Wolves killed 76 privately owned livestock last year. That was a drop from the previous year, but higher than the 16 killed in 2019. The majority of the attacks happened in the northeast part of the state. State biologists suggested last year that the wolf population in that area may have reached its ecological limit, and that packs will probably spread west and south in bigger numbers. Wolves in western and central Oregon are protected by the Federal Endangered Species Act and are off limits for lethal removal.
Certain ultra-efficient homes called passive houses use up to 90% less energy for heating and cooling than conventional homes. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. A well-insulated, airtight thermos or cooler can keep your coffee warm or your water cold all day. So-called passive houses are not all that different. Like a thermos, they're designed to keep heat from entering or escaping. So their design focuses on what's called a building's envelope, the walls, windows, roof, and foundation that separate the inside from the outside elements.
Good insulation, making a building airtight. We also want windows that can keep out the solar radiation in warm climates and bring it in cold climates.
Katrine Klingenberg is co-founder of Passive House Institute US. The nonprofit certifies passive homes and trains people to design and build them. During the winter, very little warmth escapes from these ultra-efficient buildings. And in summer, very little heat seeps in. So passive houses use up to 90% less energy for heating and cooling than conventional homes.
Most people have a giant furnace in their houses because the envelope is leaky and not well insulated. So they need a lot of energy to make up for that heat loss.
By cutting back on homes' energy use, passive houses help limit the carbon pollution created by buildings. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
It's Wednesday, and that means a visit from KBOO News poet Dan Raphael, who's wondering if the justice system is either.
How systemic is the legal system? The threat of random enforcement? Are there not enough police or too many? How many people have you seen going through red lights recently? I got a photo radar ticket last month, paid it because I know I sometimes speed, like most people, got half my money back, a kind of negative lottery ticket. Is there a law against accidents? Must there always be someone responsible, some way to be compensated for bad luck? Read of a man suing the city of Portland because he twisted his neck avoiding a tent on the sidewalk. This guy has a record of past lawsuits, either dropped or settled out of court. With few public defenders, most arrests are pled down. No bargain, admitting to something you didn't do to save legal fees and maybe jail time. And Trump won't be convicted by a jury of his peers because so few are close to his equals and none of them would ever have to serve jury duty. For poetic justice, the only kind I can afford, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 17th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Jenka Soderberg, Chris Gow, and Reed Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is the delightful Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Alex Gonzalez, Eric Tegadoff, Farah Siddiqui, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO.